Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. This is Ryan Tripp. I'm here as host for New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm here today with Associate Professor of German at the University of Notre Dame, Tobias Bose. He recently published Thomas Mann's War, Literature, Politics, and the World Republic of Letters, again, published earlier this year, actually last year, by Cornell University Press. Welcome to the podcast, Professor Bose.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, first off, what prompted you to study Thomas Mann and the International Republic of Letters?
Yeah, so my initial motivations in starting the project were actually quite different from what the book ultimately became. For one thing, it's a project that was much more abstract and academic in nature than what I ultimately produced. My original training is in comparative literature, and I have a special interest in the field of world literature, which is the question of how literary texts circulate beyond their culture of origin. And when I first conceptualized the book, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I focused a lot of energy on a hypothesis that was then very common in world literary circles, namely that authors, if they want to succeed in the global arena, have to rid their works of any overtly national characteristics. That is, they have to write in a style that is easily translatable. They have to avoid cultural allusions that an international audience won't be able to understand, and so on and so on. And I had long been a fan of Thomas Mann and was struck by how easily his example seemed to disprove this hypothesis. I mean, Mann was an intensely German author, not just in the way in which he thought of himself, but also in the way that he wrote. He cultivated a very Germanic style, very long, convoluted sentences. He was extremely deeply immersed in the German cultural tradition. And yet I knew that Mann was a celebrity in America during the 1930s and 40s, and that he was a celebrity not despite of, but rather because of this very intensely Germanic character. So maybe a little bit of biographical background here is in order. Thomas Mann had won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1929. And he was an early and outspoken opponent of the Nazis. So when the Nazis came to power in 1933, he happened to be outside of the country, and it was clear from the very first moment that he wouldn't be able to go back. And he spent the first few years of his exile life in Switzerland, but then eventually decided to come to the United States in 1938, where he stayed until 1952. And during that period, he not only continued to write in German, but works that were immediately translated and published in America. But he also gave public lectures and did various other things. And he was immensely immensely popular. And so I decided I wanted to write a book to that would explore how that happened and that would investigate how Mann himself thought of his position within world literature, or what I call in my book the World Republic of Letters. And in the past few years, a number of other critics, such as Gloria Fisk, Timothy Aubrey, or Alice Kaplan, have pursued similar questions. And so we now have a much better understanding how much of contemporary literature has what Gloria Fisk calls a tourism aspect. That is, we now, I think, more deeply understand that people pick up books in part because they want to learn about faraway places. So cultural identification can be a great marketing tool as long as it's not too deep, not too complex. And so as I began working on Thomas Mann, I, of course, became immediately aware that his popularity, his position within the World Republic of Letters, depended to a great deal on his political activism. But at first, that was very much a secondary part of the project. And then in roughly 2015, 2016, shortly after I had concluded my original survey of primary and secondary sources and done my first archival work, the world just sort of changed. And first, there was the ascendancy of right-wing populism in Eastern Europe, and then Brexit and the election of Donald Trump here in the United States. And so suddenly this whole question of Mann's struggles on behalf of liberal democracy is positioning against fascism, which had seemed fairly remote to me when I began the project, those seemed a lot more pertinent. And I also came to see a link between Thomas Mann and more contemporary authors like Salman Rushdie, Orhan Pamuk, Elif Shafak, authors who are similarly acclaimed not just for their literary work, but also for their outspoken criticism of their native governments. And so the book changed quite a bit as a result of that. I foregrounded the political elements more, even though the literary questions are still central to the work. And I made a more conscious attempt to write for a non-specialist audience, one that knows very little about Thomas Mann and is maybe not trained in literary criticism.
So can you touch a little bit on his reflections of a non-political man and his pre-1937 conceptions of Jewish peoples?
Yeah, so the reflections of a non-political man were Thomas Mann's great work that he published during the time of the First World War. And at the time, he was a very different writer from what he ultimately became. He was at that time a much more conservative nationalist, and he set out to write the reflections of a non-political man, basically to defend German culture against what he thought of as the intrusions of Western civilizations by the Western powers, especially Britain, France. But there are some barbs against America in there as well, actually. And he also wanted to actively differentiate a notion of German art against specifically German literature against French and British literature, which he thought had succumbed to the lure of politics, had let itself be involved in imperialist projects. And German art, by contrast, he thought was something that stood above the fray, so to speak, that was independent of all of those political concerns. And at the same time, since you asked about his conceptions of Jewish peoples, Thomas Mann, like many German intellectuals at the time, was kind of a genteel anti-Semite, as we sometimes say nowadays. So he had certain troublesome opinions that he mostly kept to himself, although there was also a brouhaha about one of his early stories that he eventually had to pull because of anti-Semitic elements that were in there. So all of this, in other words, made him a very different kind of author from the kind of person that he became in the 1930s, somebody who was not only much more philo-Semitic, but also developed very different understandings of the role of German culture in the world at large. And my book really begins in the 1920s as a way of setting up some background for Thomas Mann's later ascendancy in the United States. So the 1920s were not only the decade in which he first became popular in America, he was first sort of seriously translated after the end of the Second World War, but it was also the decade in which he began to shift quite considerably in his political opinions towards the world. And he came to see at that point in his life that German culture had a role to play within a Europe at large. He was at that point still far removed from thinking about what he later would call Weltdeutschtum or Germanness in the world, cosmopolitan Germanness. He was at that point still thinking on a merely European scale. But after the devastation of the First World War, Mann realized, and he was far from the only writer of his generation, and I think this is a story that has oftentimes been forgotten nowadays, he realized that intellectuals and artists would need to reach out to one another, would need to reach out across linguistic and national barriers. The international pen centers that are still with us today are one institutional outgrowth of that. And Mann was very involved in that, and that is sort of the first step that he took away from his earlier nationalist positions, and towards something more international and cosmopolitan.
Let's talk a little bit more about that change. Why did Mann's habitus of modern representative authorship diverge from past authors and his contemporaries? And in response, if you can address that attempt to connect him to middlebrow audiences in the 30s.
Sure. So what I would say separates Thomas Mann from virtually any other author is his fundamental ambiguity about being a writer. He had an early novella called Tonio Kürger, in which he analyzes this in great deal. And it's basically the self-conception that Thomas Mann always had was that of an artist who stands apart from the world and who looks at quote-unquote ordinary people with a certain amount of longing, even though he knows he can never really be a part of them. And that longing for normalcy, that kind of flirtation with ordinary life, I think is what separates Thomas Mann from most of the writers who were just a few years younger than him, who would form the proud cohorts of the avant-garde in the years following the First World War. And yet at the same time, Mann was also a student of Friedrich Nietzsche, who had absorbed Nietzsche's main insights about human language, which is that language is never just innocently descriptive of external reality. Nietzsche realized that language is a means by which we construct reality, and Mann's realization of this fact, or his acceptance of that fact, along with his reflections on the social implications of it, those are what make him a quintessentially modern author, one who belongs to the 20th century rather than the 19th. And this kind of fundamental ambiguity, this sort of being between things, not quite being a part of the avant-garde, but not quite being a part of the 19th century either, and this flirtation with what he would have called ordinary life, those fundamentally shaped his habitus, that is, his public self-presentation as a writer. So his fictions are always stylistically uncompromising. They're dedicated to a pursuit of truth that can be achieved by means of art alone. But he was also very level-headed about the fact that art, once it's released into the world, becomes a commodity like any other. In other words, something that needs to be packaged and promoted. So he understood that consumers who buy a book do not thereby acquire a piece of literature alone. They also invest in an image of the author, who becomes a part of that commodity that people are purchasing. And that self-understanding is what made him, I think, particularly marketable in the United States. I mean, Thomas Mann did not take a super active interest in the way in which he was promoted and marketed in the United States, at least not as at first. But still, there were certain things about him that other people could easily latch onto and use to promote. And when I talk about other people, I'm thinking about his American publisher, Alfred A. Knopf, and cultural critics of the time like Henry Seidel Canby or John Erskine, who in the 1920s, which, like I said, is when Mann was first sort of promoted in America, they began to market European literature to their countrymen as a means of intellectual self-improvement. And so they form what we now collectively call the middlebrow cultural formation in America. And that's a term that I realize to many contemporary listeners will sound slightly derogatory, but I use it without any sort of aspersion, simply to refer to the attempt to advocate for intellectually serious literature by stressing its ostensibly pragmatic benefits. And Thomas Mann could very easily be appropriated for these middlebrow purposes, because he rejected avant-garde posturing, he stressed his bourgeois origins, which made him very acceptable to the American middle classes. And he was also could very easily be put into the position of somebody who was capable of explaining the European mindset, of explaining why the First World War had happened, what would have to come after the First World War. His activities within the European Republic of Letters made him very suitable for that. So The Magic Mountain, for instance, which was published in English translation in 1927, was the most important work in that regard. And people like Knopf promoted it precisely by saying, you know, pick up this book and read it, and you will understand why it was that Europe engulfed itself in the flames of war. And after Hitler came to power, that kind of intellectual prestige that he had could easily be shifted from a more European arena, which is where he was situated in the 1920s, towards an image of Thomas Mann as an embodiment of a particularly German kind of culture, a spokesperson for the German cultural tradition that had been perverted by Hitler. Already in 1934, there were intellectuals in America like Sherwood Anderson, Kenneth Burke, Langston Hughes, and other people who were actively calling on Thomas Mann and saying, you know, you are the person who needs to step up and needs to confront Hitler in that fashion. You need to show that German culture is not just Hitler. And Mann, it took him a while to actually do that, but once he did so in 1936, he was very rapidly embraced in America and was even stylized as what one newspaper called Hitler's most intimate enemy.
So in his 1937 On the Problem of Anti-Semitism and his 1938 Joseph in Egypt, how did and why did Mann wrest coeval mythology from fascism and paradoxically situate it within the U.S. West, contemporary events, and Judeo-Christian traditions?
Yeah, so Mann's sustained attention to the problem of myth is probably what I would think of his most important contribution to the struggle against fascism. And before I talk about that in detail, maybe important to understand that his interest in myth originally had nothing whatsoever to do with politics, but it stems from a profound shift in his literary strategies that took place in the midpoint of his life in the 1920s. So broadly speaking, the ideas for the stories that Mann wrote before that shift in the 1920s, during the first half of his career, those ideas practically all came from personal experience. So Mann actually really did go on a vacation to Venice, where he met a beautiful young boy, and that became the kernel for Death in Venice. He really had spent a few weeks in a tuberculosis sanatorium in the Swiss Alps, and that became the kernel for The Magic Mountain. So autobiography always came first, even if it was then transformed into something much more general through the alchemy of his art. But starting in the 1920s, Mann turned to world literature as a source of inspiration for what he wrote. And practically everything that he produced after that point in time was a reworking of literary materials that had been invented by others, including very centrally mythic and mythological materials, such as the Old Testament in the monumental Joseph novels, which occupied him basically from the late 1920s to the early 1940s. But also other sources such as Indian legends in a short story, The Transposed Heads, which also came out in the early 1940s. And so just as this transformation was happening, just as Mann was shifting towards rewritings of earlier stories, including stories from mythology, fascism came to power in Europe, first in Italy and then in Germany. And analysts of fascism on the political left quickly came to realize that one of the reasons for fascism's success, one of the reasons why it had outsmarted communism in the war of popular opinion, had to do with the fact that it appealed not to reason, but rather to primordial feelings, to tribal sentiments, to class rather than to class solidarity, to the maxim of an eye for an eye rather than to enlightened judgment, and so on and so on. And this realization was one of the cornerstones for the various popular front movements that sprung up around the world, including in America during the 1930s. And in which communists did common cause with socialists and left-leaning liberals to create what they thought of very consciously as a new mythology by which to oppose fascism on a sub-rational level. So in the United States, this cultural project took the form of, say, Aaron Copland's musical pieces like Fanfare for the Common Man, or Carl Sandburg's four-volume Lincoln biography, in which Lincoln was stylized as this larger-than-life hagiographical figure, and so on. And Thomas Mann had connections to various popular front projects. This is not something that most people remember nowadays, although the extent to which he was consciously influenced by what they did is open to the debate. But be that as it may, the idea that democracy can only stand its ground against fascism if it puts down roots in myth, that is very much central to the first lecture that Mann gave in America after he came to the country in 1938, which was The Coming Victory of Democracy. And he toured the country with that, and he basically argued that democracy was as much a state of being, an emotion, than it was a political system. And that people needed to relate to it on a fundamental level of feeling. But much earlier than that already, He had discovered that his ongoing preoccupation with the biblical story of Joseph and his brothers, which again he had begun in the 1920s at a much earlier time, that preoccupation with biblical stories had actually handed him a potent tool in the analysis of the fascist mind. So, for instance, the savagery with which Joseph's brothers treat him, in which they throw him down the well, that that made a great allegory for the cruelty with which Nazi brown shirts were hounding down Jewish citizens who also sort of believed that they belonged to the tribe, that their services to Germany in the First World War had rendered them above approach, had rendered them model German citizens. And so that was an important intellectual development for Mann, who, as I already mentioned earlier, up through the early 1930s, had participated in the casual and often not so casual anti-Semitism that blinded many German intellectuals of his generation. But now he sort of came to understand that the persecution of the Jews was an attack not on an external element, but rather also on a fundamental part of German identity itself. And at the same time that all this was happening, you know, the status of Judaism in America was changing as well in response to the news of the European pogroms. For much of its history, America had thought of itself as a Christian nation, but now this new concept of America as a Judeo-Christian nation that was at war with godless fascism acquired some currency. And so in the book, I relate this somewhat amusing story of Thomas Mann's American friend and patron, Agnes Meyer, who wrote him a letter about her reading experience of Mann's Joseph novel, Joseph in Egypt, during a vacation that she took on a family cattle ranch in Wyoming. And so she was settling down by some stream and reading this book. And in her mind, the biblical landscape kind of blended with the landscape of the American West, and in her mind sort of supported this notion that there was this primordial war of good versus evil going on, and that America would have to play an important role in that.
During the 30s, again, why did Mann become associated with the New Deal and a German cultural tradition in Ivy League scholarly circles, and then anti-Nazism in the public sphere?
Yeah, so I think we're talking about several different things here. So first of all, Mann's association with the New Deal deserves to be mentioned. When we talk about that, we need to understand that Mann was not a particularly practical thinker ever. He spoke with great eloquence and conviction on topics such as democracy, freedom, in the abstract, but he never really had a very firm understanding of the reality of day-to-day politics, and especially not of American politics. He did, however, have an almost idolatrous devotion to Franklin D. Roosevelt and to his policies of the New Deal. Mostly, and this is where we tie back to the mythic elements that we discussed in your last question, mostly because he saw in FDR an almost sort of allegorical, larger-than-life opponent to Hitler. Roosevelt's physical handicap combined with what Mann always thought of as his moral rectitude, those seem to make him the exact antipode to Hitler's obsession with Aryan physical strength and with what Mann always called his verhunzte moral nature, that is his stunted, undeveloped moral nature. And Mann had an admirer in Eleanor Roosevelt, and since the Roosevelts and the Manns had friends in common, they were twice invited to the White House. They dined with the president, but it would appear that FDR was considerably less interested in literature than his wife, and that his famous visitor unfortunately never really left much of an impact on him. But that's not the only way in which Mann related to government circles. There was also his tenure at the Library of Congress. So for that, we need to turn to one of his great American promoters, Archibald MacLeish, who in 1939, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning poet, and in 1939, he was appointed the Librarian of Congress. And he entered that new position with very grand plans to transform the library into a weapon in what would later come to be known as Roosevelt's arsenal of democracy. And what this meant was that McLeish created a fellowship program through which he tried to attract leading scholars with practical expertise in areas useful to wartime America. And he brought them to Washington, and he gave them the opportunity to shape the acquisitions policy of the library and create bibliographical aids so that the library could put itself in government service during this time of crisis. But McLeish was, of course, also a poet, and he had very idealistic opinions about the role that a poet could play in a democracy. And that was part of what he did at the Library of Congress as well. He created a lecture series about literature and democracy. And as he was doing this, the aforementioned Agnes E. Meyer, the woman whom we just met in Wyoming, who was the wife of the Washington Post owner, so a very, very powerful woman in Washington circles, and a great admirer, a great friend of Thomas Mann's. So Agnes E. Meyer came knocking on Archibald MacLeish's door and approached him with the idea that maybe Mann should be given a courtesy appointment as a consultant in German literature, which she would pay for. MacLeish seized on this as an opportunity to involve Mann, who already had quite a reputation as a lecturer on behalf of democracy in more sort of populist venues, to bring him to Washington and have him lecture in front of government circles as well. And so as part of Mann's contract, he was asked to come once a year and give a talk in Washington. For various reasons, he didn't come quite that often, more like every second year. But his talks were attended, his talks at the Coolidge Auditorium at the Library of Congress, were attended by cabinet officials, Supreme Court justices, foreign ambassadors, and so on. And those provided him with a quite powerful venue to put some of his ideas before people who were involved in the U.S. government at the time. And some of his strongest lectures of the time period, including his talk, Germany and the Germans, of 1945, which I think of as the best thing he ever wrote in sort of the non-fictional arena, resulted from that collaboration. Now, you mentioned Ivy League scholarly circles as well. So that was another important thing that happened during that time period, because this was a time period in which a lot of U.S. institutions were changing as a result of what was going on in the world. And Princeton University was one of them. It had created back in 1936 an interdisciplinary so-called special program in the humanities, which was created largely out of anxiety of humanists at the time that the social sciences were gaining an ascendancy. In an age of mass politics, social scientists were acquiring a lot of social prestige in U.S. culture, and the humanists kind of wanted to get in on that game. And so they created this interdisciplinary program at Princeton as a way of talking to one another, as a way of emerging from their specialist disciplines. And when he relocated to America, Mann was given a temporary position as a visiting lecturer in this special program. He taught there he lectured there. It's an exaggeration to say that he taught, but he occasionally lectured over the span of three semesters. He lived at Princeton for 3 years in total. And that was important because it gave him financial and residential stability. It gave him a certain amount of social prestige. And most importantly, it provided him with the time that he needed in which to work. Though in terms of actual anti-fascist activities, it probably proved to be much less transformative than the stuff that he did in Washington, largely because the German department at Princeton didn't really know what to do with him. So he kind of stayed by himself for much of his time. And then finally, you mentioned his reputation as an anti-Nazi in the public sphere. So I already talked about very briefly about how this began very early back in 1934, when various American intellectuals published an open letter in the New Republic urging Thomas Mann to speak out against fascism. Over the later 1930s, because of op-eds that he wrote, essays that he published, but most importantly, because of various lectures that he gave, he really transformed himself into a very well-recognized figure, even with ordinary people, somebody who was cheered when he appeared in newsreels and stuff like that.
So let's zero in on the 1939 Lotte in Weimar. So in Latvia and Weimar, how did Mann critically reconstitute Goethe as a representative author? And if you can, please address that post-war investigation into his sources.
Yeah, so from the moment that I began this project, I knew that Lotte and Weimar would represent one of my biggest challenges. And in fact, the pages devoted to that work were some of the very first that I ever wrote. And most listeners of this podcast will probably never even have heard of the text. And that, of course, is part of the challenge. So the basic story is this. In the mid-1930s, before he even came to America, shortly after he had finished the third volume of his four Joseph books that he was writing at the time, Mann decided to take a sort of break by writing a short comic novel. And that novel is Lotte in Weimar, which was published in the United States first in 1940 under the title The Beloved Returns, but is now known as Lotte in Weimar, which is also the German title. And it's a novel that's loosely based on historical events. It tells the story of an old age reunion that actually took place between the famous author Goethe and his former love interest Charlotte Kästner, who is famous nowadays for having been the real-life model for the character of Lotte in The Sorrows of Young Werther, which was the novel that had launched Goethe's career when he was still a very young man, so over 40 years earlier. And the sort of comic novel about how these people who had been lovers at a much earlier point of their life reconnect in 1816, it's one of Mann's greatest novels, in my opinion. It's unjustly forgotten, but it also presents formidable challenges to anybody trying to write a book about Thomas Mann as an anti-fascist intellectual during this time period. I mean, I've just talked about how in the Joseph novels, Mann had found a way to wrest myth and mythology away from fascism, how he tried to repurpose it for democracy. I've also hinted at the ways in which Joseph was kind of an ideal vehicle through which Mann could connect to an American audience, simply because American audiences could easily relate to that biblical subtext. It was a familiar story. But those Joseph novels actually sold very, very well in the United States. And then, so the weird question then is, when he arrives in 1938, he's well underway on writing this project, Lotte in Weimar, but he has by no means finished it. He's maybe halfway done with it. And so why didn't he just set aside that manuscript and begin working on the next part of the Joseph novel? Because that is what Americans were waiting for. That's what sold. And he must have known that his audience in exile would have very little patience for this story about a very obscure element or a very, very obscure episode in Goethe's life. This is where the fundamental Germanic nature of his writing that I talked about earlier comes through. Well, and one way to answer that question is that it was actually an attempt for Mann to continue his engagement with fascism on a mythic level by wresting a foundational myth of German culture, Goethe himself, away from the Nazis. So Lotte in Weimar is very much a story that stresses Goethe's fundamental cosmopolitanism, his distrust of romantic nationalism, and Mann actually puts some of the lines from his own lecture scripts into Goethe's mouth in that novel, and he also came up with new lines for him. For instance, passages in which Goethe complains about the berserker excesses of his countrymen and their tendency to abandon themselves credulously to every fanatical scoundrel that comes along. So pretty clearly stuff that was minted at or that was targeted at contemporary events. But there's an alternate question, answer to the question, why did he write Lotte in Weimar? And that would have to do with the form rather than the content of the novel. So in the central chapter of the work, which is the one that Mann wrote after his arrival in America, Mann takes us inside the mind of Goethe, and he does so by means of an extended montage sequence. That is, he splices together literally thousands of quotations from Goethe's works and his letters, from observations by contemporaries, from posthumous biographies, and from critical works. And the result is so seamless that it seems like an organic reconstruction of the mind of a great thinker. I mean, as you read the novel, if you don't have critical apparatus to explain it to you, you would never guess that none of this is stuff that Mann actually came up with, and that it is, in fact, from very many different sources all cobbled together. It's mechanical rather than organic in nature. It's an amalgam of two centuries of cultural tradition, or an amalgam of what two centuries of cultural tradition had made of Goethe. And so in my book, I postulate that this was, on one level, a kind of therapeutic exercise for Mann. So he too had reached great author status. And at the time, the Nazis obviously were leaving a jackbooted stamp on German literature by tossing all the books that he deemed inappropriate onto bonfires. And Mann rightly worried what subsequent generations would come to think of his works and how they would be able to access them. And those worries would turn out to be well-founded. In your question, you alluded briefly to the afterlife of Lotte in Weimar after the Second World War. So what happened after the Second World War is that Mann's fake Goethe quotes about German tendencies, you know, towards berserker excesses and abandoning themselves to fanatical scoundrels made their way to the German press. And for a while, they were actually credited to Goethe. They were deemed to be authentic. And when that was actually discovered, it generated a great deal of embarrassment, not just for the German scholars who had failed to recognize as fake a quotation that had been attributed to the greatest German writer of all time, but also incidentally to the occupational authorities, because the British at the Nuremberg trial, the British chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials had actually used that quotation as an indictment of the German mind. And now they had to acknowledge the fact that, you know, Goethe actually never said that. And so to me, that's a very illustrative anecdote because it shows that Nazism really did have an effect on German culture. After 13 years, the German cultural tradition had been deeply warped, had been changed. And so Mann's worries about, you know, how will I live on in German culture? How will later generations access my work if all they have is, you know, critical works and whatever survives of what I've written in whatever form? How will they be able to piece that together into a picture that actually does justice to me? Those questions seem to have been well-founded.
So that same year, 1939, he published Brother Hitler. How did this engage with the artistic roots of fascism?
Yeah, so Brother Hitler is an essay, and it was probably the first analysis of fascism that Thomas Mann published after his arrival in America. He had previously toured the country with a lecture script that I already mentioned, The Coming Victory of Democracy. And that's another really important text. But as the title suggests, it's really more about democracy and how to make it emotionally appealing and strong than it is about fascism itself. And Brother Hitler is a very strange text in Mann's overall oeuvre, and one that critics haven't always known what to do with. For one thing, it's the first essay that Mann arguably wrote with an American audience, at least partially in mind, because it was commissioned by an American publication, by Cosmopolitan magazine, of all things. It ultimately came out in the spring of 1939 in Esquire magazine. So these were decidedly middlebrow venues, and that has also baffled critics, especially German critics who didn't quite know what to do with that, being unfamiliar with the reception history of Thomas Mann in the 1920s and early 1930s that I've already talked about a little bit. And it's also an essay that actually was published in English translation a few days before the German publication came out in an emigre journal. So it signals a fundamental shift in the way in which Thomas Mann is being received under conditions of Nazi censorship on the continent. But the really strange thing, I guess, about Brother Hitler is the actual argument that it advances, namely that an actual kinship exists between Adolf Hitler and Thomas Mann himself. Mann actually says explicitly, "This man is my brother." And that's the title under which Esquire magazine also published the article. Now, arguments that attacked Hitler as a kind of failed artist and artist manqué, those were very common in the 1930s, just like attempts to, for instance, attack Donald Trump based on his history of bankruptcies are common now. And it was a very easy way, but also a somewhat facile way of engaging with him. I mean, Bertolt Brecht, for instance, has that famous line where he denigrates Hitler as a house painter. But that's not what Mann is doing in this essay at all. He is, in fact, taking Hitler quite seriously, and he points out the extent to which fascist spectacle, think of the Nuremberg rallies and stuff like that, to which those were influenced by sort of post-Wagnerian aesthetic developments, and the same post-Wagnerian aesthetic developments that had also influenced Mann himself. So he understood that Hitler wasn't a failed artist at all, but somebody who had grasped how to apply techniques that had originally been developed for the theater and apply them to a new context, namely mass politics. And so one could almost say that Mann in this essay articulates the same central insight that Walter Benjamin had already formulated 3 years earlier in his very well-known essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, which is that the fundamental aim of fascism is to aestheticize politics. Now, whereas Benjamin responded to his insight into fascism with a call for communism to politicize art, Mann took a much more introspective turn, and he looked back critically at his own infatuation with Wagner and Nietzsche during the early years of the century. And he asked himself whether he too didn't contribute to a kind of intellectual nihilism that ultimately led to the rise of the Nazis. And so I think that is what makes Brother Hitler a very interesting essay for a present moment in which liberal democracy once again seems to be threatened by the rise of an unfettered and largely fact-resistant populism. There's a big difference between Twitter and fascist mass rallies, of course, but social media disinformation campaigns, just like fascist rallies, rely on the insight that if you stage things properly, you can convince people of almost anything. And that is something that I think Thomas Mann understood as well. And at the same time, in writing Brother Hitler, Mann made himself a forerunner of contemporary intellectuals who also asked themselves, you know, were we perhaps somewhat culpable in contemporary developments? Were we too cynical in our writings, for example? Right. These are ideas that I think are very interesting, but that Mann didn't really pursue in his later public pronouncements. So he was the Deseret News newspaper from Utah, like I said earlier, famously declared him to be Hitler's most intimate enemy. And the intimate part of that equation sort of dropped out during the course of the early 1940s, once Mann fully embraced his role as a figurehead of the anti-fascist cause. But Mann's thoughts about fascism as an essentially theatrical dynamic certainly did influence also his descriptions of Egyptian culture in the Joseph novels, for instance, where the rights of the Egyptians are contrasted with the much more sober monotheism of the Jews.
So let's move to his lecturing. Please trace the development of Mann's popular lecturing in the United States, including his Chautauqua predecessors, his move to that Weimar of the Pacific, also known as the Pacific Palisades, a community that I'm familiar with, and promotion by Howard Harold Pete, etc.
Sure. So that's probably my favorite topic to talk about from all the book. So as I mentioned already earlier, Mann was marketed in the United States during the 20s as a kind of explainer of the European worldview for middlebrow audiences. And so very early on, actually, already in the late 1920s, there were attempts to bring him over to America as a popular lecturer. And at first, nothing really came of this, in part, I think, because Mann didn't really understand what he was being asked to do. In Europe at the time, writers didn't really do that kind of thing. That's, go on popular lecturing tours. That's something that scientists, retired politicians, and so on did. But authors gave public readings, certainly, and Mann was very prolific in that sphere, reading from his own novels and so on, but they weren't really asked to comment on the public events of the day as Mann was being asked by his American inviters. But then once he was driven into exile by the Nazis, these requests from the United States suddenly became a whole lot more attractive because, quite frankly, he needed the revenue stream. And Mann was being offered a lot of money. For his first lecturing tour in 1938, he received $1,000 per appearance, $15,000 in total for 15 lectures, which was roughly the annual salary of a college professor at the time, and sort of in the same ballpark as what he earned through royalties for all of his books combined. And so it was lucrative, and it also was an easy way to win a new audience for himself in America. And so between 1938 and 1943, he toured the country five times, each time with a different lecture script in tow. He gave a total of 90 lectures in this fashion. He spoke of audiences that averaged somewhere between maybe 2,000 and 6,000 people, so quite big crowds. Overall, several hundred thousand people heard him, and they heard talks with titles like The Coming Victory of Democracy, How to Win the Peace, or The War and the Future. So very much talks that engaged with contemporary reality. And these were highly professional events. He had a lecturing agent, Harold Pete, who was a giant in that field. He also represented H.G. Wells and Winston Churchill, amongst many other famous clients. There was a very professional ad campaign with, I think, a beautiful poster that is reprinted in my book. And he spoke at prestige venues such as Carnegie Hall in New York City or Constitution Hall, which belonged to the Daughters of the American Revolution in Washington, D.C. But crucially, he didn't just speak in those large coastal towns, but he also traveled to many smaller communities all over the country, to Tulsa, Topeka, Colorado Springs, Salt Lake City, Birmingham, Mobile, Greensboro, tiny Lewiston up in Maine. He spoke at colleges and universities. He spoke at civic theaters and synagogues. So he didn't just reach the intellectual elites, but also ordinary Americans, the kind of people who maybe purchased his books, The Magic Mountain or Joseph and His Brothers, but who then probably struggled to get through all 500 pages of those novels. Those kinds of people came and heard him deliver these talks. And so they were important for the ideas about democracy and about fascism that he presented, but I think they were also important for the form that they took. And this was an age, as I've already intimated, of mass politics, of mass spectacle, not just in Europe, but also in America, where you had organizations like the German-American Bund or the America First Committee, which were holding political gatherings that were fairly similar to the ones staged in Germany and Italy. And the question was, how could democracy possibly compete with these rousing participatory assemblies, right? And I think Mann's lecture stops gave an answer to this question, an answer that wasn't totally unlike the one that Roosevelt developed by means of his fireside chat radio addresses. The fireside chats worked because they used the radio to promote a notion of intimacy and equality between the leader and his people, which was very suited to democracy and very antithetical to what the Nazis, for instance, were doing, or what Hitler was doing with the radio. And Mann's lectures worked in the same way. By comparison to, for instance, America First events, they were very small in scale. They were unassuming. They allowed people to actually have some sort of meaningful interaction with this famous person, this guy who was billed as having all the answers about fascism and the future of democracy. Mann, it has to be said, absolutely hated this part. He hated the question and answer period when ordinary Joes could just ask him any question, whatever. He wasn't used to this from Germany. His English was terrible, and he never comments on the questions in his diaries, which I take as a symptom that he thought they were mostly trite. But I think this format was a hugely important part of what made these events so successful. And in the book, I try to show how Mann's lecture tours tapped into a very long history of public lecturing in the United States that Mann actually was wholly ignorant of, but that nevertheless conditioned his success. So there were the Lyceum lecture tours of the mid-19th century. There were the Chautauqua circuits of the early 20th, which were basically mixtures of religious prayer meetings with edifying lectures on all sorts of topics. And historians of that subject have shown these itinerant lectures had always been used to create and to shape Republican self-perception in the United States. So they were ways from the very beginning to create what literary critics would call imagined communities. So in other words, people who listened to a lecture in Columbus, Ohio, were very much aware of the fact that the same lecture had been delivered in Philadelphia or in Boston just a few days earlier. And through that awareness, they could imagine themselves as taking part in a national discussion, in a discussion that even in the 19th century already frequently included questions such as, what is American democracy, or what should our foreign policy aims be? So Mann was really reactivating something that had quite a history in America, and that that enabled him to be as successful as he was. So I think Munn's lecturing activities show us how plugged into American culture he was at the time. Not plugged in the sense that he understood American cultures, which he didn't really, but rather in a way that there was something about him that probably engaged with U.S. public opinion. And so that's why I actually don't like the name Weimar on the Pacific, which is oftentimes applied to the German exile community in the 1940s. To me, that label implies a certain amount of political disorganization and also a dwelling of the past. I mean, those are the two things that, you know, Weimar evokes to me. And by contrast, I like to draw attention to the fact that Munn lived and worked in the Pacific Palisades, which is a name with a certain kind of bellicose swagger to it that I like, even though it actually has nothing to do with the military. It was dreamt up by a developer who wanted to bestow some of the prestige of the Hudson Palisades on California real estate.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Very interesting. So in your book, you discuss a little bit about ideas that you refer to as conservative anti-fascism, as well as responsible liberalism. How did conservative anti-fascism and responsible liberalism shape Mann's lecture precepts, or not shape his lecture precepts?
Sure. So when we think about theories of fascism that were produced during the 1930s and 40s, I think most of us probably immediately think about left-wing theorists like Walter Benjamin, Franz Neumann, Friedrich Pollock, Siegfried Krakauer, and so on, Frankfurt School people and their coteries. But there were important conservative anti-fascists as well, and Thomas Mann read pretty much all of them and was intimately connected to most of them. There was Giuseppe Antonio Borghese, for example, who happened to be Mann's son-in-law and was the author of a work called Goliath, The March of Fascism. There was the cultural philosopher Erich Kahler, the author of a book called German Character and the History of Europe, who was a close friend of Mann's and his neighbor when he still lived in Princeton. There was Hermann Rauschning with The Revolution of Nihilism, or Peter Feerick with Metapolitics, From the Romantics to Hitler. And in my book, I discuss these figures, and I point out that their theories have several common characteristics that can also be found in Mann's work. The first of those is that unlike most left-wing critics, they approached the rise of Nazism as a topic to be considered from the vantage point of cultural history rather than from political or economic theory. And they also like to think on a grand scale, reaching back to the Middle Ages, or in some cases, even to the Roman period, to explain contemporary predicaments. And this was immensely useful to Mann, since on the one hand, you know, he didn't know very much about economics, but he was very much at ease talking about literature and music. And the basis of his fame in America was a cultural one as well. And so the proximity of Mann's thoughts to all these conservative figures doesn't necessarily mean that he himself was a conservative, however. That's the way in which he is frequently received in the United States nowadays, but his actual political convictions, beyond the fact that he was very much in favor of liberal democracy and very much opposed to fascism, are quite difficult to untangle. American liberalism had a very strong pull on him as well. And in my book, I focus on a movement that at the time was sometimes called responsible liberalism. And that was exemplified by people like Archibald MacLeish, whom we've already mentioned, or Lewis Mumford or Reinhold Niebuhr. And these so-called responsible liberals advocated for a strongly interventionist foreign policy that put them into opposition with the so-called pragmatic liberalism that of people gathered around John Dewey, who was an anti-interventionist. And their militant stance on foreign policy also, that was something that that aligned with Mann's own. But another thing that Mann and the responsible liberals had in common is that they took a rather idealistic approach to the question of democracy. That is, they thought of democracy as a calling, a social code, something almost spiritual, not just a, an operating procedure for society. And they thought that contemporary American intellectuals had neglected to sufficiently advocate for this sort of democratic creed. And this, too, aligned very well with Mann's own beliefs. I've already mentioned that he wasn't a very practical kind of person. He didn't really think about day-to-day realities of politics. He had very idealistic notions about how to defend democracy. He believed that the main task of the intellectual was to make sure that it didn't die off, that it was cared for, that it was maintained, that it had, had a spiritual resonance in people. And so these conservative and liberal strains, in fact, are oftentimes difficult to disentangle from one another. So there's the example of the 1940 City of Man conference, which was a gathering of intellectuals from all across the political spectrum that assembled in Atlantic City in May 1940, just as the British were evacuating their troops from Dunkirk. And so this was sort of the darkest hour for Europe. And at that time, the intellectuals that gathered there, including Mann himself, who was one of the sponsors of the conference, they turned their thoughts towards the future and towards what a post-war order might look like. And the document that they produced makes for very interesting reading, even though it remained utterly without consequence. Mann actually gave a copy to FDR when he visited the White House, but it's doubtful the president ever even looked at it. But what the declaration shows is that at a time when fascism seemed on an unstoppable march through Europe, progressive and conservative thinkers were united on the one hand in this kind of soul-searching endeavor, you know, have we somehow neglected democracy? And on the other hand, they were willing to consider grand gestures to breathe new spiritual and intellectual vibrancy into the fight with fascism. And I think that makes it a really interesting document to look at in our present era.
What transnational and transmedial processes transformed Mann's subsequent German service BBC broadcasts into disembodied and haunted messages of German cultural tradition?
Yeah, so now the topic of our conversation is shifting to a different sphere of Thomas Mann's activities during the 1940s. His lecture tours, his appearances at the Library of Congress, his essays such as Brother Hitler, those were aimed primarily at an American audience. They sought to offer an analysis of fascism and to simultaneously explain why the struggle for democracy was actually worth fighting for. But at the same time, Mann never really lost sight of his German audience. He continued to work in German, and the ideal reader that he had in mind as he composed his novels was always German. But because of the extremely efficient censorship measures the Nazis put into place, those works had a hard time reaching actual readers in the Reich. And so during the 1940s, they were far more consumed in translation than they were in the original German language, which is something that interests me greatly. But radio waves, on the other hand, those were far more difficult for the Nazis to censor, though they certainly did try. And so the BBC in particular ran a much studied propaganda operation during the wartime years, and that included many broadcasts in the German language. And from 1940 to 1945, Thomas Mann was one of the broadcasters who lent his voice to the BBC's German service. He recorded a total of 58 propaganda broadcasts that are collectively known in the English-speaking world by the series title Listen Germany. And these broadcasts are interesting in part, I think, because they're fairly different from most of the other broadcasts of the German services. And it's important to note here that the BBC exerted almost no editorial oversight. Mann was free to talk about whatever he wanted. And so he did what he always did, which is talk in a fairly abstract register. But in his best moments, he used these radio addresses to reflect on the nature of German guilt in the Nazi crimes and to warn his countrymen that the American punishment would be severe and would be utterly deserved. And he didn't even back away from this assessment after Allied bombers laid waste to his hometown of Lübeck. So they're quite interesting rhetorical documents for the positions that they take. But what I'm also interested in my book is the way in which very specific rhetorical strategies that Mann developed for his radio addressees and medial contingencies of getting his voice into occupied Europe, how those combined to redefine the social position of the author. So what do I mean by that? It's important to remember that Mann did not sit, unlike most of the other broadcasters that the BBC employed, Mann did not sit in a recording studio in London. He instead recorded at the NBC studios in Hollywood. His voice was recorded on a phonograph record. It was then flown to New York City. And the BBC at one point considered actually using Royal Air Force bombers to transport these phonographic records to London so that they could play them there. But that plan was considered to be or was deemed to be impractical. And so instead, the records were played in front of a microphone, and the recording was sent via transatlantic telephone line to London and was re-recorded there, was edited, recorded one more time, and then broadcast over the radio. So by the time that his voice actually makes its way to occupied Europe, there's been a great loss of signal quality. And his voice has, so to speak, become very ethereal. It's more located in the radio waves than in a concretely locatable physical space. And whether he did so consciously or not, Mann cultivated a specific form of rhetoric that seemed to correspond to this ethereal nature. He was very fond of biblical expressions such as, "But I say unto you," or "Have no fear." And he frequently adopted this prophetic and even messianic attitude in which he promised deliverance from the evils of Nazism in his lectures. And there's admittedly a certain amount of pretension to all of this, but it also makes for an interesting fit of form and message in my mind, because after all, Mann was no longer addressing his countrymen as a fellow German in the conventional sense of that term. He stood completely apart from their collective experience. But he wasn't really addressing them as an American either. I mean, the whole point of the propaganda broadcasts would have been lost if the Germans had perceived him as, an enemy combatant. So what exactly was he? From where did he derive this authority, since his works no longer circulated in his home country? He was condemned by the official literary institutions of his state. And Mann's diction and the way in which his message were mediated by the radio, those came together to suggest that his authority came from someplace higher than the national community.
So let's move to the end of the war and his 1945 Germany and the Germans. At what point did Mann begin to identify as a representative of quote-unquote cosmopolitan Germanness rather than solely German Kultur?
Yeah, so that's a key question for the project as a whole. And the first thing to understand is that Mann had always, even during the early nationalist days of the Reflections of a Non-Political Man, with which we began the interview, he had always had a fairly non-traditional understanding of what German culture actually was. And without going into too many of the details, he believed that the essence of German culture was essentially musical in nature. And that's an idea that we find in a lot of other 19th century German thinkers, although it's perhaps a strange thought for a literary writer to have. And music, of course, is capable of transcending national and linguistic boundaries like no other art form is. So in that sense, for Mann, German culture had always been cosmopolitan, had always been Weltdeutsch, which is the term that I translate as cosmopolitan Germanness. And that's a term that Mann came up with towards the end of the Second World War. But this idea of a cosmopolitan aspect to German culture, that you could be a part of German culture and identify with it, even if you weren't in Germany or didn't even speak the German language, that is something that we find already at a much earlier point of his life. But he certainly doubled down on this idea during the 1930s and 40s. I already talked about how, as he positioned himself in opposition to the Nazis, he began to claim a spiritual affinity between the true Germany, the Germany of which Nazism was an essential perversion, and Judaism, because Judaism, to his mind, too, was a cosmopolitan religion. And he now argued that German culture would never have reached the heights that it actually did if there hadn't been a constant influx of Jewish talent to German literature, art, and music. And around the same time, of course, Mann's own position as a writer in the world began to change. And I think this is absolutely crucial. And it brings us back to the questions of habitus and promotion with which we began the interview as well. So his former audience in Germany was closed off because of censorship. And so he discovered a new audience for himself in America. And along with this new audience came new sources of institutional affirmation through Princeton, through the Library of Congress, through American critics like Hermann Weigand at Yale University or Howard Nemiroff. And Mann learned, in other words, that German culture wasn't just the exclusive property of the German people, but it was something that other people took an interest in as well and that they helped maintain. So if the Nazis and the German-speaking people who cheered them on turned their back on him, that didn't necessarily mean that he was, by definition, banished from German culture as such. There were other ways of holding up that flame, and people in America were doing so. And so to turn now to Germany and the Germans, which I already identified earlier as what I think of as really the most significant essay that he wrote in his life. So it was a lecture that he gave. It was originally a lecture that he gave at the Library of Congress in 1945. And it was then disseminated in both Germany and the United States through various print media. And it's certainly a text that argues for a cosmopolitan understanding of Germanness, of German identity, along the lines that I've just articulated. But it's much more than that. It's a real tour de force of an essay. It's importantly also about German guilt and complicity in the crimes of the Nazis. Mann has often been faulted for never referencing the Holocaust in his most famous novel from that period, Dr. Faustus. But if you look at his non-fictional stuff, he really finds pretty strong words there. And Mann's most courageous insight, to my mind, is that he vigorously denied the idea that Nazism could somehow be excised, separated from German culture as such. And this is a big difference between him and most left-wing thinkers of the time, for instance, Bertolt Brecht. Marxists like Brecht tended to believe that fascism was essentially a capitalist phenomenon, that ordinary Germans had been manipulated by financiers and industrialists. And Mann, on the other hand, was firm in the conviction that there aren't, as he put it in Germany and the Germans essay, that there aren't two Germanys, but rather that, and this is a quote, wicked Germany is merely good Germany gone astray, good Germany in misfortune, in guilt, and in ruin. So in other words, he believed that the roots of Nazism, of the evil Germany, were really buried very deeply inside of German culture. And in his lecture, he in fact travels all the way back to the time of Martin Luther to excavate those roots. And nowadays, this notion that Mann advocates for there, this notion that German culture is somehow different from the culture of the rest of Europe, which is called the Sonderweg hypothesis, is deeply unpopular. And it is, in fact, true that Mann's argumentation is at times a little far-fetched. But the moral courage of his claims to me is nevertheless clear. This is a time when most of his countrymen were busy shifting the blame as far away from themselves as possible. And Mann was essentially saying all of us Germans have something of this evil inside of us. All of us need to search within us and need to reflect. It doesn't even matter what you individually did. This is not a question of your individual crimes during the time of the Nazi regime, though Mann was certainly level-headed about the fact that the Holocaust was not just committed by a small clique of SS officers, but that it required broader cooperation. But Mann thought that even if you were anti-fascist, as he himself was, you needed to reckon with the fact that if you identified with German culture, you also, in some way, identified with the dark currents that had made Nazism possible. So Mann definitely believed in what we now call a Kollektivschuld, a collective guilt, and he called on his countrymen very eloquently to do penance, a task from which he did not exclude himself. He did have dim views about collective punishment, however, as it was being advocated at the time by people like Lord Vansittart or Henry Morgenthau. He believed that the Allied powers should not punish the Allies, but should instead educate the Germans, that they should help create a new state that would bring out the very best of German culture, that would lead Germany back into the community of nations, that would strengthen this Weltdeutsch, this cosmopolitan German element. And that, of course, is fortunately what ultimately happened.
So let's talk a little bit about Mann at the early on the eve of the Cold War. How did the typological and analytical layers of his 1948 Dr. Faustus, which you have already alluded to, reveal his struggles over the contours of a global republic of letters? And if possible, can you address that ideology of modernity during the Cultural Cold War?
Yeah, so Dr. Faustus is a text that Mann finished in 1947 and was published in English translation in 1948, so right at the beginning of the Cold War. And it's unquestionably the most sophisticated fictional work that he wrote during the period of his American exile. And it's, along with The Magic Mountain, it's the novel that has endured the most of all of his texts. And it's basically a retelling of the Faust myth through the life story of a composer of modern music, Adrian Leverkühn, who combines in his biography and in his thought elements that Mann drew from Nietzsche, from Arnold Schoenberg, from Theodor Adorno, and other sources. And it's also Mann's most explicitly modernist work, both in terms of its formal composition and in its artistic intentions. And basically, what I mean by that is that in the years leading up to the composition of Dr. Faustus, Mann had started engaging, though only at second remove, with the works of James Joyce. So he didn't actually read Joyce himself, but he read works about James Joyce. And he was very afraid. He instantly recognized, even at second remove, what a formidable author Joyce was and how he was reshaping modern literature. And he began to fear, I mean, he was a pretty old man at that point, he began to fear that history would not judge his own oeuvre very kindly in the face of such self-evident formal experimentation. And so he tried his hand at a more experimental style than he had sometimes engaged in the past. And he conceived of Dr. Faustus as a multiply coded work. That is, the story of Adrian Leverkühn, it's not only a life story, but it's also an allegory on multiple different levels. It's a narrative about the development of modern music and of aesthetics during the early 20th century. It's also an allegory for the intellectual roots of fascism during the same time period. And it's a story about the development of German culture from the early modern period to the present. So there are passages of the novel that are actually written in sort of early modern idiom as we sink into deep history, so to speak. And the American critic and sort of pioneering theorist of modernism, Clement Greenberg, in an unpublished manuscript that I found amongst his papers in California, I think he was the first person to describe this quote-unquote typological structure of Dr. Faustus and connect it to the modernist movement more generally. And Greenberg had some doubts about whether Mann had ultimately been successful in his intentions, but that's not really the question that interests me. I'm much more concerned with the pragmatic uses to which the novel was put in the post-war era. That is, I'm interested in the connection between modernist form and ideology. And so you have to understand, first of all, that with the end of the Second World War, Thomas Mann's career was at kind of an impasse. For the past few years, he had built himself up as Hitler's most intimate enemy. But now Hitler was gone. Mann himself was an old man. U.S. attention rapidly shifted away from Germany and towards the Soviet Union. So was he still relevant, even beyond the formal question? Did he still matter? And most prior critics have pointed out that attention does indeed seem to have waned to quite a large degree. Dr. Faustus and the works that came after it didn't sell nearly as well. Well, actually, Dr. Faustus did sell well, but it wasn't well critically received. And then the stuff that came after was basically a failure, both critically and commercially. And they also highlight, other critics have highlighted, that with the advent of McCarthyism in the United States, Mann's career very quickly went down the drain. He had been an early and outspoken enemy of the Nazis, and in the America of the time, that turned you into what was known as a premature anti-fascist, that is, as a suspected communist. And Mann really lost his faith in the United States. He lost his faith in United States democracy, which he had so vigorously defended just a few years earlier. And eventually he left for good and settled in Switzerland in 1952, 3 years before his death. So that's a very sad story. But there's a different component to it that I pursue in the book. And I try to show that there were rivaling forces in the U.S. government who actually did think that Mann and Mann's formal experimentation would make a powerful ally in the new fight against global communism. So this is where modernism and ideology meet in my work. And the specimen case that I examine is Melvin J. Lasky, who ran the German language cultural journal Der Monat out of a small publishing house in West Berlin. And that was a journal that was actually secretly, as was later revealed, was secretly funded by CIA money. And Lasky was very interested in Dr. Faustus and in Thomas Mann more generally. On the one hand, because it is a novel that exalts in modernist experimentation, but also because it talks explicitly about the invention of 12-tone music as a subject matter. And Lasky thought that he could use this for propaganda purposes. It's because Dr. Faustus seemed to prove to him, or seemed to illustrate, that great art will flourish only in the absence of government intervention, and only if art takes an abstract subject matter, if it is left to its own devices, if it can be about formal questions like 12-tone music is. And that, of course, was the very opposite of what the communist position was at the time. And it's something that the U.S. government was very, a conception that the U.S. government was very involved in promoting at the time, if you think of Jackson Pollock in the realm of painting, for instance. So Lasky gave a lot of room to Mann in the early issues of Der Monat, and he courted him personally as well, though Mann took a rather dim view of him. He called him a narrow-minded fellow who lives and thinks in his American propaganda bubble and mistakes himself for Hamlet. Pretty cruel words. But by contrast, Lasky's great antagonist in the Eastern Bloc was Georg Lukács, who was drawn to Dr. Faustus precisely because he saw it as an allegory about the fallen condition of art in the modern capitalist world. For him, the whole book was a tragedy about the social alienation of the artist, who is so separated from the productive forces of society that he engages in these empty formalist games like 12-tone music. So you had two different readings of the same novel that were carried out with radically dissimilar ideological ends. And ultimately, I think both of these strategies proved futile, in part because Mann was simply not a person who was intellectually or constitutionally suited to put himself in the service of somebody else's agenda. And he always thought in abstractions, not in concrete realities, which made him a very slippery tool for cold warriors to use. And as one example of this, we might consider his actions during the celebrations of Goethe's 200th birthday, which is when Mann decided that he would return to Germany for the first time since he had left in 1933. And the cover illustration of my book actually shows him during that return in Frankfurt in front of a bombed out cityscape surrounded by cheering crowds. But Mann crucially decided not just to return to Frankfurt, which was in the western half of the country, but also to the great other Goethe city, to Weimar, which was in the east. And this absolutely enraged the American press and American government officials, because they rightly thought that the Soviets would try to exploit this visit to Weimar for propaganda purposes. But Mann didn't really concern himself with such deliberations. For him, German culture could simply not be split into two parts, and that's what he wanted to demonstrate to the world. And it was as simple as that.
So let's conclude with the Mann legacy. So during the 70s and 80s, how and why did Mann's posthumous disclosure of homosexuality shift critical assessments of his work to private aims? And if you could touch on a little bit how his exile foreshadowed contemporary developments of world literature.
Yeah. So for me, as for just about anybody else who works on Thomas Mann, one of the most important sources are his diaries. And those fortunately cover the entire period of his American exile. He destroyed most of the volumes from his younger years, but we have the volumes for the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And so when he died in 1955, he stipulated in his will that those diaries had to remain under lock and seal for 20 years. And when they were opened in 1975, they were received with great fanfare. And the resulting revelations that they contained had a profound effect on Mann's reception, because they shifted attention away from the public persona that he had built up for himself in America. They shifted attention towards his personal successes and his anguishes, which is a little bit incidentally like what I think we currently are seeing happening with the archive of T.S. Eliot's love letters, which were opened up to the public on January 1st of this year, and which seemed to contain quite some, you know, some dynamite material. And so, as you mentioned, the biggest revelation to emerge from the diaries was that Mann was gay, and that had a great impact on Mann's reception. I mean, we had just gone through the sexual liberation movement, and so those revelations fell on very fertile critical ground. For better or worse, Alan Bloom, in The Closing of the American Mind, which came out in 1987, for instance, is quite disapproving of Mann. His argument basically is that Mann used his fiction as a projection surface for his sexual fantasies, as a kind of escape from reality, and that he persuaded his readers to seek similar escapes from the demands of reality. So that's quite a different interpretation from of Mann's lasting legacy from the one that I'm arguing for in my book. But ultimately, I think the problem goes a little farther than that. Which is that I think we find in Thomas Mann criticism, especially in the German-speaking world, an over-fixation on biographical causation. Thomas Mann lived a life that was tremendously rich in both successes and catastrophes. It's a really interesting life, and in fact, a widely popular miniseries has been made of it. I mean, you had the Nobel Prize, receptions in the White House. But you also had lots of personal tragedies, suicides, wartime catastrophes, you know, having to flee first from Germany, then from Europe, and so on and so on. And those biographical circumstances have meant that there's a huge market, especially in Germany, where Mann remains known and popular, for popularizing accounts of him and of his family. In fact, there are currently more than 20 German language books about the Manns in print. And even here in America, you have your pick of four different biographies that have been published of him, which for a German literary figure is quite a lot. So Thomas Mann's war may, on the surface of things, be just yet one more of those biographical approaches. I mean, I write in chronological sequence. I try to keep the reader informed of Thomas Mann's most important activities because I want to reach an audience that is maybe not super knowledgeable about him. But the reality is, as I hope I've been able to show in this interview, that I'm much less interested in Thomas Mann, the living, breathing person, than I am in what in the book I always call Thomas Mann in quotation marks. That is, the sort of almost mythical public intellectual that Americans revered in the late 1930s and early 1940s, the author that existed primarily as a name on books, on lecturing announcements, in discussions by other intellectuals, and so on. I'm interested in how an author becomes a brand, how he comes to command respect for achievements that have very little to do with actual literature, and I think that kind of interest and Mann's sort of seminal role in those in developing strategies in that regard is what also makes Thomas Mann such a valuable case study for discussions of contemporary literature. He was one of the world's first producers of what the literary critic Rebecca Walkowitz has called translated fiction. That is, Mann knew that because of the censorship of the Nazis, his work would primarily be consumed in translation, and he had to actively think about how he could steer his reception in a country whose language he barely spoke. And this is a very familiar condition for 21st century authors who hail from outside the Anglophone world, but who nevertheless want to make it big in global publishing. And Mann's success, I think, was also very crucially tied just as much to who he was as it was tied to what he wrote. So in the 1920s, he was received as a quintessential European in the United States. After the Nazis came to power, his Germanness moved to the foreground. And the Americans believed that he had something valuable to tell them about fascism, not just because he was a powerful writer, but also simply because of who he was. He was from Nazi Germany. He had personally seen what had happened over there. He was sort of an embodiment of the German culture that Mann claimed still existed and that it was worth learning about and ultimately also fighting for. So calls for military intervention against the Third Reich carried a lot more weight when they were articulated for him simply because he was German rather than an American with an interest in Germany who was speaking to fellow Americans on that subject. And that, too, I think, is a common feature of 21st century global publishing. You might think here of Khalid Hosseini's novel, The Kite Runner, which was published shortly after the invasion of Afghanistan. Or you might think of the Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk, who is hailed in the West as an explicator of political Islam and is simultaneously derided in his own country as a puppet for foreign interests, much as Mann was derided by the Nazis. So if there's one thing that I hope people will take away from my book, it's that the story of an author's public persona can be just as interesting as the story of their actual life. For after all, authors live and enter immortality through their works, and the face that they put onto the world, for me, is an important part of that. It is something that deeply informs the way the works are received. It's not any less fictional than the words that they put down on the page.
So I have a final question. What's going on with you next? Is there any projects that you're currently working on?
Well, so at the present moment, I'm sort of still dealing with side projects that have developed as a result of working on this book for such a long time. So I have more that I want to say about Thomas Mann and American political culture in the 1930s. I think that's a really interesting subject and a way of bringing together German studies with American studies, which are fields that I think have much to learn from one another. I'm also interested in writing more on other German authors who came over to the United States during that time period and learning more about the various mediators that introduced them to an American public. Other publishing houses, book club activities is something I talk about in the book as well. Translators are hugely interesting to me. I basically want to find out how German culture was marketed in the U.S., what kind of lasting impact it had as well. I mean, for me as a German living in the United States, that's a hugely personally interesting topic as well. I mean, I as a professor of German literature, I get paid to be a mediator for German culture in the United States as well. So that's an interesting topic. And then ultimately for my next book, I want to actually travel into the 21st century and look at European populist movements and their cultural dimensions. I want to look at literature that is produced by intellectuals who sympathize with ascending right-wing populist movements in all across Europe, not just in Germany, although there are certainly interesting German examples. And I also want to look at literature that is produced in conscious opposition to those kind of tendencies. And I want to inquire, is even in the 21st century, in a time that's very different from the mid-20th century, is literature actually still a tool that can be used for the defense of democracy, or conversely for attacks on democracy, or is this all just sort of stuff of yesteryear?
So we hope you remember the New Books Network for those projects. So the book is Thomas Mann's War by Professor Bose. Literature, Politics, and the World Republic of Letters, published earlier this year by last year by Cornell University Press. On behalf of Professor Bose, who I thank for being on the show today, this is Ryan Tripp for New Books in History, a channel on New Books Network. Please tune in next time.